Welcome, everyone. It is, that's right. It is 11/11. It is November 11th for us in Canada. We would call this Remembrance Day. And in the States, I know it's Veterans Day. I'm not sure if in other European countries there's any equivalent, but if there is, thank you to all of those who have ever served. I have many friends who have, family who have. Armistice Day, that is right. And so, for all those listening to the recording, I just asked everybody here live, just to give everyone a heads up, what is your somatic word today? Could be anything. And the reason I share this is in group workshops where it's in person, and say we have 30 people, if you can imagine, it takes a long time for 30 people to check in and say how they are or how a lesson was. And so what Ilya and I have done, who's done his movement lessons, by the way, yet? Has anybody dabbled into some of his, one of my favorites is the teacups. We came up with the somatic word, one word to describe how one is sensing, feeling in the moment. We're pretty lax. It doesn't have to be somatically based, but some of the words today I have here are cold. Yep, that's somatic. Okayness. tired. Good. Damp. Vibrant. Calm. Excited. Challenged. Worried. Listening. Lonely. Heavy. A bit restless. I'll hyphenate that. A bit restless. One word. Anxious. So, this is something that you can play with even for yourself when you're just hanging out. And sometimes you find the chatter in the mind starts to do that because we've got these really powerful brains. If you can catch yourself, and that's a big part of this work, is being able to catch yourself and go, oof, I'm spinning, or I'm collapsing, or I'm worrying, or I'm blah, 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 whatever it is. Can you name the somatic thing that's under that cognitive firehouse? Does that make sense? Or what's under that kind of decline and collapse? And yeah, someone said, I'm not sure how I feel. So that could be a, huh. Kind of like a gesture. So, somatic word, it can be a fun one to play with and then see how that changes as you sense, and even before you do a lesson or after you do a lesson. Okay, so today we have Rebecca here. Hello, my dear. Why don't we, do you want to unmute just so people can hear your voice?
Hello.
Hey, good little Kathleen Turner action there.
Yeah, I was eating a piece of chocolate, so
Oh, lovely. What kind of chocolate?
milk.
Nice.
I like
Yeah, you're a milk gal like me.
milk.
Yeah. We have an ongoing joke within my team between the dark chocolate people and the milk chocolate people. And we joke that the people who love the 99% are kind of crazy and psychotic. So, not really, but gosh, it's so bitter. Just not my favorite thing. So I love milk chocolate. All right. Thanks for being here in the chat as we need. Thanks, Susan, for being here. And by the way, if you love dark chocolate, that is great. Power to you. It's apparently very medicinal. So we're going to get into training call number five. And the handout title, the title for today is ANS. So that's short for Autonomic Nervous System and Self-Regulation Review, and the two sections, the two sections. And so I'm going to do a bit of review, and some of this is, it's review. It is in the Biology of Stress videos. And as you remember, for some of you who were here and taking in the class last week, it was part one for anger and healthy aggression. Today we're taking a pause from that topic. Next week is going to be part two for anger and healthy aggression. And Seth, actually, as you all know, Seth, husband and colleague, who does many of the Q&As. He'll be teaching the training call next week. So you're going to get a little guest visitor to go into healthy aggression part two. So as a review, and I'm going to keep saying this over and over again, reviewing is actually really important. Write that down on a post-it note. The need to continue to come back and review the basic lessons, even the theory, is super important. I often will give the example that learning how to regulate your nervous system is like learning a second language as an adult. And for those who have done that as an adult, very different than our mother tongue, where we don't remember learning how to speak and learning how to hear all the things and pronunciate. And so, because for many of us, I'm going to say everyone here, because that's why you're here, we're relearning how to have regulation in our nervous system for many of us the first time. And that requires repetition. And this is one of the, I don't want to say it's a dirty little secret, but let's use that. That's one of the secrets of SBSM is not about just going through and then saying, okay, I've done it. And then going, okay, where's my regulation? Right? It needs repetition, just like for anyone here who's raised a little one, or you have nieces or nephews or grandkids, you know that that little one takes constant repetition to learn a task, to learn a skill, to learn how to write, to speak. And then for those of us who do sports or any kind of a hobby, it takes a while to master something. So just know that going back to lab one is great. If you're still in lab one, that is okay. Really watch that language in your brain that creates a story that says, I suck at this because I'm so behind. And if you have that in you, notice it. Don't be mad at it, but notice it and go, okay, that's old programming. And it's super important to bring yourself into a learning and learning situation in the way that you would want to teach a child how to learn, without pressure, without strain, without force. And so this ability to really give yourselves the benefit of the doubt that it's okay to still be on lab one. It's okay to be popping in and just hanging out and listening to these training calls, but not sure if you really get it yet. It will come. We've done this enough times to know that with time, as we get more capacity, we get those balls out of our pool, the cognition starts to drop and it starts to really land. As a note, next Monday, I'll be releasing an interview with one of your peers. I interviewed her last year. Her name is Bernadette. Did anybody catch her interview where she was talking about becoming a substitute teacher? She's from the States. And we do a part two talk, and her story is a beautiful example of how the cognition, our higher brain, and our ability to focus and complete a very big task. In her case, she got her university degree to become a school teacher at age 56. Land on that, right? We think we have to get through university in our 20s, right? And some of us do, and there's nothing wrong with that. But she couldn't because she had so much complex PTSD due to all the things, all the childhood stuff, that she could not focus. She could not even fill out a college application. And so when she started Smart Body, Smart Mind, and even 2 years ago, she still couldn't fill out the college application. And she did it. And she went through and she graduated and she's now teaching and shaping young minds at grade one with fun and regulation and care and connection. So, yeah, service to others via nervous system healing, Bernadette's story. So that's from last year, and we'll be doing a round two. And if you really want kind of that extra view of how folks change, you'll see in the first interview how different she is now compared to a year ago. That's what I wanted to say. She's still really put together and fun and all those things. But you can really see the drop in her regulation a year out. And I share that with you because she started SBSM years ago. And I don't share that to discourage anyone at all. I share that to show when you consistently stick with it, do little bits, titrate, and keep towards your goal, so much can shift and change. So do not underestimate what you have capacity for if you're finding it hard to get through lab one. That's my long speech around don't worry about being behind. You are, in this case, being individualistic is very important. Very important, right? Only compare yourself against yourself. Okay, let's dive in. I'm going to have a little tea here. Everybody, make sure you know where you are in your seat. I'm going to stare outside at the trees for a moment to let my eyes have a break. All right. So, speaking of review, biology of stress video number three. So, this is page one that we're at the top of the page. That video really goes into the different branches of the nervous system in a bit more detail. So, of course, you get this from different angles, but I really wanted to review this again today. We're going to, if you want to play with me, I'm going to do hand gestures. So, play along. And as I said last week on the call, if it feels right to speak out what I'm saying or what you're writing, that can help reinforce what you're learning, you know, in service of good elementary school teaching. You got to bring all the learning tools in, visual, writing, speak, body, right? And that helps really gel what we're learning. So, recap of the nervous system. So, there are two. Numero two, two main nervous systems in vertebrates. Vertebrates is just a fancy word for saying spine. You have a vertebral column, a spinal column. And then the first one, central nervous system. Central nervous system. And the central nervous system is the brain and the spinal cord. So, again, if you want to play with me, brain here, head under the skull, and then phew, spinal cord down the middle. As I've learned from Elias, sound effects help. Phew, right? Shows all the way down. And that brain and spinal cord obviously is really important. It's central because it's in the center of our body. Now, the second type of nervous system is the peripheral nervous system. So that's number two. One is not better or more important than the other. They're both very important. But for the sake of linearity, we're putting them one and two. So two is the peripheral nervous system. And who knows what periphery vision is, right? You're all sitting here, but you can, if you have your hands, play with me. And behind you, there comes a point where if you're looking straight ahead, you see them. Right? You're sitting here, if there's a window, you can kind of tell that's there. If a flashing light comes through because a car drives by, you see that. So peripheral means on the outside. So the peripheral nervous system is the autonomic nervous system. That's the next line down. Autonomic and somatic nervous system. Go to the next one, to the next sentence there. It's a longer one. Between all of these nervous system branches are pathways, sensory and motor, that communicate signals, action, and survival. So I've shortened that. So signals, sensations, heat, cold, stimuli. Ooh, that's bright light, that's loud music, hormones, adrenaline. Right? All the things that adrenalize us. Oh, I'm sleepy. Melatonin. Tons of hormones that we have in our body. We would call them chemicals that release for human function. So, metabolism, homeostasis, keeping our temperature in check, keeping energy in our system, metabolism, and action, movement, and survival. So while that's a small sentence, that's it. That's ev not everything, but it's a big chunk of what goes on within our nervous systems, right? Now, let's make sure I don't. Yeah. So if we think about the central nervous system, we have nerves that come out of our brain. So again, if you want, play with me here. You've got nerves coming out of your brain. They're cranial nerves. We can't obviously see them. If you go to an anatomy book and you look up cranial nerves, you'll see all these various nerves that come out of the brain. One of the nerves that we talk about a lot in trauma work is the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve comes out of the brain, hence cranial nerve, but then it becomes our peripheral nervous system. And it snakes through, it goes to the face, it goes to the throat, it goes to the heart, the lungs, the gut, the groin, all the viscera. Now, I've got my two drinks. I actually have three drinks with me. I always have three drinks. So if you have a drink in front of you, play with me. Bring it up. Or if you have, your handouts, of course, you can move them over your head. You can take your pen and manipulate and pretend you're drawing in the air, your name. This is motor movement, but you're also sensing. I can sense that this is hot tea. It's not so hot that I can't hold it. This is cold coffee. It was poured hours ago, right? Very different. So we're sensing and then we're manipulating. Now there's heaviness to this compared to if I pick up my lip balm, super light, right? Almost to the point where I can't feel it, but I'm sensing it and I can feel the point at which, if I drop it, and I won't because it'll make a loud sound, I can sense and maneuver through this peripheral nervous system that's coming out of the central nervous system. So it's quite elaborate, this sensory motor nervous system, and we take it for granted, unless, of course, we have damage to it. If you've ever had anybody in your family, maybe a friend, a partner, or maybe you have had nerve damage or a stroke. One of the easiest examples is who has ever had a tooth pulled out, and you get freezing. And then you try to drink your tea and it falls out of your mouth, right? Because you can't sense it. Or you eat something because you're starving and then you bite the inside of your mouth because you can't feel, you can't sense the area. I want to paint this example to make you understand that this isn't just about nerves that are random. We're using our sensory motor nervous system all day long. Just like our autonomic nervous system that comes out of this central nervous system governs the tea that we drink. So we take a sip of tea, you don't have to think about it moving down, right? The digestive canal. Creating urine in the kidneys, and then you pee it out. You don't have to think about that. But what we know is when we have high survival, so I want to bridge this with why we're doing this work, right? When we have high level of survival stress, lots of these trap traumas, these balls in our pools, the system is over-focused on survival, survival, threat, threat. And so the nerves, the peripheral nerves, the autonomic nervous system nerves going to properly digest the tea or the food, they're like, eh, I got all this other worry. This person, my owner thinks that a tiger is in the room. I better look for that tiger. Or my owner is overwhelmed, meaning us. So I'm going to collapse and I'm going to shut down, rest, digest, even though they're about to go to sleep right now. And we're not going to worry about digesting that food. We're not going to worry about sucking up the hydration from the chamomile tea they had before bed. We're just going to pee it out. And then we wake up and we have to pee. So, this is a very kind of crude example of how these nervous systems work. And if we're co-opted towards stress and survival, the autonomic functions that govern these internal organs kind of get put to the side. Just like our ability to discern and have nice, soft, refined movement will also be not so great if we're always hypervigilant or if we're collapsed and we have no muscle tone in our body. So all these things coalesce. And of course, the goal of smart body, smart mind, and what we're learning, this building capacity and removing the balls, is helping the system come back to better function, homeostasis, that word here, so that we're not worried about the survival all the time, except for when it's important, right? If there is an actual tiger in your room, best to do something about it, right? If there is something that is really stressful and difficult, best to feel it, but then we want to process that and move out of that stressful event, which is something that I talked about in previous training calls when we think about when to orient, when not to orient, when to resource, when not to resource, et cetera, when to take a deep breath, when not to take a deep breath. Okay, so speaking of tea, again, remember to take care and move as you need to. So the ANS, next line down, has two branches. So we have two nervous systems, and now we're talking about the autonomic nervous system, and it has two branches. And then it has sub-branches. Again, this is a review from Biology of Stress video number 3. So the sympathetic nervous system, which is our fight and flight. So that's the first line there. That one is pretty simple. There's a strain, there's a stress. I better fight it. I can't fight it. I better flee. As some might know the saying, get the heck out of Dodge. Get out of here, right? Gotta get out of here. Parasympathetic nervous system, next one, the PNS, is our slowing down survival system. But it has a little bit more intricacy. So the PNS is broken down into two more branches. So we start with central nervous system, peripheral, there's two. Then we have the autonomic nervous system has two main branches. And now the parasympathetic, we're going even deeper. It also has two main branches. So one, we call it the speedy, primitive, unrefined, unmyelinated shutdown. That's the word, nervous system. This is the fancy term, the dorsal vagal complex of the PNS. This is the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve has many different functions. One is to quickly shut us down and slow us down. I have a really bad accident where I maybe cut something, a vein, not a vein, wouldn't be a vein, an artery. That's very, 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 very dangerous. The system notices that, and what does it do? It slows our heart rate down fast. It slows our blood pressure down fast. It draws all the blood into the core, into the center, so that that limb, let's say I again, knock on a lot of wood, I injure that brachial artery in the bicep. I want that to slow down. This is why, has anybody done first aid training or industrial aid first training, like big training? If you have a bleed, what do? You put a tourniquet around, right? Tie it off so that blood can't come out. But we also want our system to go into survival. That is one of the jobs of this speedy, unmyelinated part of our parasympathetic nervous system that is also the vagus nerve. So, page two. Go to page two. But then there's this other branch of the parasympathetic nervous system, and it is also slows us down. Remember, I said on the first page, the parasympathetic is all about slowing down, but there's different kinds of slow. So the one that I just mentioned on page one is fast, quick, uh-oh, it's uh-oh slow. Like, we need to get this down. Page two, steady, refined, we would say myelinated. Myelinated just means that there's fat covering the nerve. If you ever learned biology in grade 12, you would have learned about these sheaths around our nerves that make the pathways faster. It's kind of not exactly true. It makes the pathway more refined. and it's more evolved. This is a more evolved part of our nervous system. The words there, calming down nervous system. This is called the ventral vagal complex of the PNS. Why is this important? So it's important because it's important to realize the vagus nerve isn't just one thing. It is many branches, and we haven't even gotten to the next level of complexity because these dorsal tones, which are come up next, have, or I should say, the dorsal vagal complex, the one that is unmyelinated on page one, has two different tones, not branches. It's all written down here, so you can always review this. So I'll get into this in a second. But the reason why it's important to understand this is right now there's a lot of stuff out there where we have to fix the vagus nerve, we have to stimulate the vagus nerve, we have to tone the vagus nerve. And I understand why that's being taught, but it's not accurate because our vagus nerve does many things. And if we just go in and try to maneuver it and manipulate it, it actually might manipulate in the wrong direction. Actually, I saw, I think Jerrica is here, one of our alumni. And I did an interview with her, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, and we talked about in that interview, it's open source, how she had some vagus nerve massage. I'm really going to simplify it, but some form of body work working with the vagus nerve. And she had a hell of a time after that, and her system went into overactivation. One might even say seizures. It was really intense for her. She shares her whole story. She's wonderful now and really good and healthy, but that is an extreme example of why I'm very, I will say, against anything that tries to go in and manipulate that vagus nerve because you just don't know how it's going to react, right? So the one thing I'll also add here, I said on page one that the shutdown nervous system is primitive. What that means is, this is more evolutionary. If we think about reptiles and the deep, deep sea creatures, we don't really hang out with them. They don't have a good ventral vagal capacity. Now, I know some folks love having reptiles as pets. I'm not one of those. I prefer cats. But, you know, one could say you can have a relationship with a reptile, but they are more primitive. And the deep sea creatures are very primitive. The reptiles are cold-blooded. The deep sea creatures can be in cold. And so they have this ability to really slow their heart rate down when they're deep, deep in the sea. What that allows them is to not need oxygen a lot. And that's why we cannot, as humans, go into a body of cold water and do very well for long periods of time, right? Hypothermia is a real thing. We can die. We're not cold-blooded, and we're not meant to be in the deep sea like the polar bears or the whales. And so they can do that because they have a very, very sophisticated slowing down, high-tone dorsal shutdown nervous system. Now, this doesn't mean that they, you know, as we know, that some of the deep sea creatures have are mammals and they have babies. So there's complexity here. But for humans, we want to be living for the most part in our ventral vagal complex, page two, more evolved. And I'll get into this in a bit more detail. So just wanted to lay that ground. That's why we say primitive. We have that primitive physiology in us. It's what turns on again when we have an accident and we go into shutdown. And that's why, what happens when you're in shock? Can you write an essay? No. Your brain kind of turns off. You go primitive, right? Everything comes in, the core gets protected. Okay. So just when we thought it couldn't get more complicated, here's where it gets more complicated. Page two, we're still on. So this complex, this primitive dorsal complex of the parasympathetic nervous system, it's more unrefined, has two main modes that it operates in. Two. So there's the number two again. Excuse me. Two main modes it operates in at the top of page two. The first one, low tone dorsal. The second, high tone dorsal. Next line, low tone is true rest digest. Low tone is true rest digest, parasympathetic nervous system, and is responsible for recovery and healing of the body's many organs and organ systems. So often it gets thrown out. Parasympathetic is rest digest, right? Many of us have probably heard that. It's true, but it's not the whole truth. Part of the parasympathetic is rest digest, and it's this low tone aspect of the dorsal branch of the PNS. So this rest digest, this low tone, next bullet, there's four bullet points here, supports tissue repair. So if you have a cut, I actually got a cut last night. I don't know how I got it. I got this fun little band-aid on my finger. Don't want to show you because I'll give you the bird. It's on my middle finger, right? So you get a cut. That repairs, that's tissue repair. Who here has found that as they have maybe gotten more regulated, and this might be some more the alumni, or maybe when you're more stressed, your tissue healing is slower, right? What happens as we gain more regulation is cuts and burns and scratches, scabs, they heal a lot faster because we have more healthy rest digest on board because our system isn't being co-opted into survival. Immune system response, super important, obviously. We want our body to be aware of foreign things coming in and appropriately do what our system is supposed to do. Maybe we need to get a fever. Maybe we need to get a little inflammation around an area. You sprain your ankle. It swells up for a reason. It swells up so that the joint is protected and it lets the tissues heal. Third bullet point, barrier keeping of the gut. Barrier keeping of the gut. This is important for anyone here who has what we might consider Crohn's, IBS, anything gut related. So when we go to sleep at night, what we want to have happen is we want the system to go into this rest digest. And one of the things, and I'm not an expert on all the mechanisms, but gut gets stitched back up. The body naturally repairs it. And if we don't go into enough rest digest consistently, the gut leaks. So a lot of people have maybe heard of the concept leaky gut. Some people would say it's food-based, some people will say it's based on other things. At least in our world, we have seen that when we get more rest digest, the gut has a better chance of repairing at night, and that's what strengthens it. Because we need that healthy rest digest when we're sleeping at night. And then the next one, cell repair and regeneration. Again, you could say this falls into the tissue repair. To me, tissue is more the skin, the hair, the nails, whereas cells is all the things, all the cells in our body. So for healing and health, next line down, for healing, health, and our smarts, so our cognition to be restored, we want all of these three branches to be in sync. The low tone, the high tone, and what's called the ventral. So, I'm going to add one more piece here. High tone dorsal. Go back to page number one, you guys. That's the final bullet point. So, high tone is this shutdown, this quickness, this collapse. Whereas low tone is the rest digest. Here's the best analogy I can think of for this, for dorsal branch of the vagus. Who here drives a standard transmission car? Anyone? Most of the Europeans will, usually, or the UK folk. Most Americans and Canadians don't drive stick. It's just one of those things. But if you have a standard transmission, obviously the engine is the engine, but then you have this gearbox, usually one through five gears in reverse. You change gears based on how fast the car is going. Pretty obvious, right? But it's the same engine. Okay, so land into that thought. It's the same engine. So what that means is this dorsal branch of your parasympathetic is one engine. Think of it that way. It's one engine. It slows down. And depending on your nervous system state, depending on your regulation, depending on the threat, or depending on the safety, it's going to be in one of two tones. High tone, which is shut down, collapse, primitive, I've got to save myself and pff, block out everything. It's the reptilian in us. It's the sea creature deep at the ocean floor that you can't see. It's the protection, right? Whereas the low tone dorsal, that's, I think of a beautiful stream with lots of running water. Can you picture that? Lots of oxygen, tons of fun little trees and mosses and bugs and little things on the water. It's got lots of oxygen, lots of aliveness. To me, that I think of a stream and I think of that's low tone dorsal. There's movement, but it's not a raging tsunami. Think of raging tsunami like fight flight, right? So, again, it takes a bit of time to really gel these in our brain. And the reason why these are important is as we begin to gain more capacity, one starts to notice, oh, I think I slept last night and I was in more real rest digest because I woke up and my poop was better. I had a better bowel movement. Or I slept through the night and I didn't get up to pee. My body was sucking in the hydration from my chamomile tea right before bed. Versus I wake up, oh, I'm so groggy. I was constantly, tossing and turning. I couldn't rest. Or I was dead to the world. Anybody fall asleep and like an alarm can go off and you don't hear it? I'm not that person. So sometimes I envy that person. But when you sleep through alarms, loud conversations, that often is a sense that you are in a very high tone dorsal shutdown sleep, right? So the system is in that gear that's at the bottom of the swamp. Okay. And then, yes, this myelination, what that is the primitive, the rest digest, and the high tone don't have that myelination. It's just the way our, we have been built. The ventral, and we're going to get into this in the next few pages, the ventral vagal, which is at the top of page number two, that is myelinated. And that is something that when we're born, it doesn't have full function yet. Okay. Yeah, thanks for say, thank you, Michelle, for admitting you have slept through fire alarms. Yeah, so while that's good for your sleep, that's not good for survival, right? So there's this interesting thing where some people like, oh, I wish I could sleep through a fire truck, moving down my lane. But if the fire's in your house, you kind of want to wake up, right? And so there's this bridge of even when we're sleeping. Even when we're sleeping, we want to have a little bit of unconscious alertness for safety, right? For the mothers and fathers here, you hear the cry of your little one. You want to be able to hear that and go and help, right? And then freeze. Yeah, someone said, is high tone freeze? Yes. So there's the other thing I want to mention here, and this is a bit more advanced, but that's okay. These stages of our nervous system, sympathetic, fight, flight, freeze, collapse, shut down, they're not like necessarily light switches. They have this blending. And so, of course, if we are being chased by a tiger, then one might say, yep, we're in flight, right? The extremes, we would say yes. If we are in total shock because we just broke a leg, then yes, we are going into freeze. We are in freeze, and maybe we're in some shutdown, but there also might be some adrenaline. But so there's like mixed states. Right now, I'm talking to you guys, obviously. I'm sitting up. I'm fairly alert, I think, but I'm not in fight flight. There's a little bit of activity in my home. I can hear it, but I'm not hypervigilant to it, right? Because the tone and what's happening out there is very minimal. Now, if there was a jackhammer or someone hammering in our kitchen fixing a cabinet, that would distract me. Then I would be a bit more vigilant. So you see, our environment and our system will have mixed nervous system states. And then, of course, those mixed nervous system states depend on our regulation, right? So I can hear a little bit of activity in that area of my home, but it's not influencing me because I know who it is. I know what's going on. It's not a big deal. But let's just say my system has had or has more activation, more unresolved trauma. I might hear those little things outside and it would be like, what are we doing? Oh, right, training call. Let's keep going, right? And it would keep pulling me. So for those here who say have trouble concentrating or focusing, and I get that there's a lot of theory in these training calls, and it'd be like, what's happening? And your mind keeps going. That's okay. But as we get more regulated, our focus is able to shift and be more focused because we're not worrying about the outside pieces that are capturing our attention for survival. This connects beautifully with the story I told you at the beginning with one of your peers, Bernadette, who is able to get her college degree because she has more regulation. It's not because her drive or her desire was any bigger. It's because she finally had more of this ventral vagal aspect of her nervous system on board and less fight flight and less freeze and shutdown. So her system was more able to process what was happening. Okay. Page two, bottom. So I'm going to read something in a moment here. So this is going to be story time in a second. So the two septions. Now we're going to come back to ventral vagal in a moment, but I want to bring in these things called interoception, and page three is neuroception. So at the bottom of page two, the first section, interoception. And interoception is our ability to perceive our internal environment. I'll explain and elaborate in a moment. One could say that everything we're doing in SBSM is dedicated, at least in the neurosensory exercises, to improving and enhancing and refining our interoception. Feeling what we notice, touch, sense, following impulse when we're hungry, all these sorts of things. Noticing when maybe we've eaten something not great, or maybe noticing, ooh, my stomach's grumbling, I need some food. My throat is dry, I need some water. These are all cues that we're listening to based on our ability to sense our insides. Page three is neuroception. And neuroception is our perception of either safety or danger. Now, depending on our upbringing, some of us constantly live in a state of assessing for danger. And I'm going to make a bet that because you're here, that that might be right why you're here. And that's totally cool. And remember, our perception of danger isn't just from childhood abuse and trauma. It can be through surgeries. This was talked about last week on the court, on the call. It could be through being in a zone of war. Our family and home life might be safe, but the external isn't, right? So I'm going to read from a book. So let me get comfy. This is on the book list. It's called Nurturing Resilience. It's a blue book. And this is written by two of my mentors, Kathy Kane and Stephen Terrell. So all of the lessons that you will have done with the kidney adrenals, the gut brain, you haven't done yet, the brain stem, a lot of the joint and diaphragm work are from their lineage, especially Kathy. So Kathy is also an SE practitioner. She also taught in the SE school. And now she's branched out and is doing her own form of work, working with touch, intention, and early trauma. I'm really oversimplifying her work. But she, for those who have been in the SE training, she is the one who pretty much developed the advanced less levels of SE where you're working with touch and the diaphragm. So just putting that out there. And her earlier training was in body work. Whereas Steve, his training is more from a psychology point of view, and he specializes in early childhood trauma, attachment trauma, specifically adoption trauma. That's one of his specialties. So I'm going to read an excerpt from this book, Defining Interoception, just because this is probably, there's no need for me to try to repeat this. And then if you want the full resource, you can purchase the book. The book is not a how-to book. The book is written for practitioners, but it is written in a fairly simple layman's way. It has really good detail around the vagus nerve and the nervous system, so it is a good read. So, interoception, this is page 26. So, interoception is the process by which we notice our internal state. We evaluate a combination of sensations and perceptions of physical processes to assess how our internal milieu and decipher what it's telling us about what we are feeling, how we are, and even who we are. That's important. This is me talking now, because as we get more tuned into our internal environment and we become more regulated, you will at some point say, I don't think I know who I am. The insides will feel foreign to what you're used to, and that's actually a really good sign. That shows that there's shifts happening. So they continue. This includes our perception of physiological processes such as heart rate, digestive process, sensations of the skin, and other internally experienced sensations of our own body. Using our evaluation of these sources of bodily information, we take action, make meaning, make predictions, and I really like their example here. So they say, like predicting our own illness by feeling the initial sensations associated with the onset of a cold, for example, right? You know that feeling, right? That scratchy thing in the throat, you're a little extra hot. And then we make judgments about who we are and how we are. Are we hungry? Are we safe? Are we loved? In this case, I'm sick. I know I've been burning it too far. I haven't been eating so well. I need to rest, right? It gives us those cues. Stephen Porges, so they quote Stephen Porges, refers to interoception as the infant's sixth sense. He defined that in 93. If an infant cannot accurately perceive whether or not he is hungry or thirsty, if he needs sleep, if he is too warm or cold, then he cannot accurately communicate his needs or distress to the care providers. That in turn can prevent care providers from responding properly to the infant's needs, which may then increase the infant's distress and instill a feeling that safety and connection are lacking. In this way, it is critical that the infant and small child develop an accurate interoceptive language for communicating her most basic needs to care providers. It is an essential, this is important, well, it's all important, but really listen to this one. It is an essential component of healthy attachment, of the healthy attachment and bonding process. As the caregiver, care provider meets the needs of the infant, attachment is strengthened. And then they go on to talking about adults. So I'll add a little bit more. As we mature, our need for a nuanced, interoceptive vocabulary becomes even more critical. We need a reference system for understanding how we feel about different people, different circumstances, and different types of needs. It's easy to assume that the system of reference develops on its own accord, but in fact, it develops contextually, requiring regular feedback from our social system in order to calibrate points of reference and rely on them with confidence. That's a mouthful. So if we step back and think about this interoceptive quality, and this was taught in biology of stress video number four as well, but we'll repeat it a bit, is when we have an infant and they feel hunger, they have a sound, they have a cry. And then, of course, we want the primary caregiver, usually it's the mother, to respond to that and feed child. The feeding lets them know someone is there for me. It soothes them, and then you have added a drop of self-regulation to that infant through co-regulation. So, as we know, many of us didn't get that. That's okay. That is why this concept of following impulse and listening to our interoceptive senses is like a huge part of our work here. Yes, the neurosensory exercises are important. They're going to teach you specific skills for working with the body, the eyes, the spine, the movement, the sound. But it is essential in your daily life when you're not doing when you're not doing the neurosensory exercises to be in this state of awareness of what does my body need, not in an obsessive, compulsive way, but gently having this internal looking. Right? And what happens is, as we get better at it, just like any language that we're learning as an adult, we have to focus on it less because it naturally reminds us. But for many of us at the beginning of this, we don't have that cue because of that high tone dorsal, that shutdown, because of the freeze. Because of the fight flight running our show 24/7, when we're in survival, the last thing we want to think about is where is my next piece of toast coming from? Right? It's survival. And so this is how we're flipping from survival-based strategy to rest, digest, and listening strategy. And that's all in reference and in service to this concept of interoception. All right. Okay. So now I'm going to move on to neuroception. This is also in the same book, same chapter, page 32. So, neuroception. Neuroception is a term coined by Stephen Porges. So, just a note, Stephen Porges was sort of the researcher. And Clinton, he's not a clinician, he's a researcher who put the vagus nerve really on the map. He is the one that really did the research to showcase that we have these varying states of nervous system autonomic function that isn't just sympathetic and rest digest. He really looked at that vagus nerve and the parasympathetic and found, oh, there are these different tones. Oh, there's this ventral component that isn't fully developed when we're little, and we need to build it up. right? This is why that old adage of just letting a baby cry themselves to sleep, we now know, is absolutely wrong. Like, this is one thing where we can say there is a right and a wrong. When that little one is crying, they need connection, they need soothing, and that is what builds the ventral vagal portion of the parasympathetic nervous system. That's what creates self-regulation. So he was the guy that really, at least in the more modern world, put that out there. So neuroception was turned coined by Porges, who summarizes it this way. So neuroception describes how neural circuits distinguish whether situations or people are safe, dangerous, or life-threatening. He also describes neuroception as a dynamic and interactive process whereby we respond to cues about safety and threat while simultaneously transmitting similar cues in our social interactions. Interoception and extraoception, so he's adding an extra word here. Extraoception is just our perception of the environment outside. Okay. Interoception and extraoception both inform neuroception. Hence, there's lots of ceptions. So, interoception and extraoception inform neuroception. Now, this is it's all important, but perk up to this one. If we have a healthy, well-developed safety system, our interoceptive and extraoceptive systems will work in an integrated fashion to help us differentiate information and determine when we are safe and when we are not. Likewise, our social systems will help us experience a sense of safety and security in our relationships, which reinforces our ability to perceive safety and experience a sense of belonging and security. So, of course, if our social systems growing up weren't safe, we have to create a new map, right? And this is a big part. This is the theory, right? It's all very much, this is how it was supposed to be. And then, of course, the work we're doing here is helping us figure out and help when it didn't get done the way it was supposed to be by natural law, essentially. And now we're doing this work to develop a new sense of interoception, a new sense of how we exteroceptively see the world. This is why we orient. This is why we have resources. This is why we seek support. We come here, we learn, we nod together, we go, I don't understand. Like, all these things are ways in which we build this capacity again. All right, I'm going to continue a little bit longer here, just a bit. In the attachment and bonding process, we learn on many different levels, socially, behaviorally, and physiologically, because so much of our behavior is based on underlying neurophysiological processes. Porges has for a long time argued for a better understanding of the physiological drivers for behavior, even when working primarily from a psychological perspective. So what this means is what this means is our behavior is driven by our physiology. Again, this is why in Smart Body, Smart Mind, it's the body first and then the mind, right? This ability to get under the rug, so to speak, under the roof of the car and figure out what's driving that stress physiology will help the behavior shift. This is critical for working with kids. This is critical for you if you have children, right? And I'm going to reference something at the end of our call around this and how, at the end of the day, kids just want to know that they have connection and that what they're doing is acceptable. Has anybody here been with a child and they're sort of toddler age and you're at a playground and the kid runs towards the sandbox or the swings, but there's a moment where they do what? I'm quizzing you all. Let's use the chat for this. What does your child do when they run? Yeah, they look back. That is safety. That is this okay? Is this okay? Right? Or have you ever seen a child who is about to do something that they don't think is okay, and they look, pulling the dog's tail, right? That's where, and we haven't gotten into healthy shame yet, too. No, don't do that. But they're testing it. These are just two very small examples of how, when we're little, we're testing the boundaries of what is safe, what is not safe, right? So I won't read any more because I know when you just hear me read, it can sometimes get lost. But if you want to dive a little deeper into definitions of neuroception and interoception, I would definitely recommend that book. It is, it's got lots of theory in it, but it is good theory. Okay. So, page four. So, this was talked about a bit more in biology of stress video number four, but we also got into it a bit on number three. So, this concept of primary wiring, I've already alluded to this. I've already alluded to this, but this is at its core what we are working on here. We're working on improving the wiring that we didn't get when we were potentially little, right? We cried, nobody was there. So now when we feel an emotion, we want to let that out, or we want to ask for support, or we want to find a resource, for example. So, back to this vagus nerve. So, the ventral vagal branch, this is top of page four, the ventral vagal branch is the social engagement portion of our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system. And it's not fully refined nor mature when we're born. So, the word there is refined. So it's not refined when we're born. And we know this, right? So first bullet, we have to learn how to use it. I'll give examples in a second. So we have to learn how to use it. Second bullet point, the refinement and wiring, that's the word, must be built up via social engagement from another more mature human. It doesn't necessarily have to be a adult. I know many people maybe here were raised by their siblings, older brothers, sisters, right? So that's another way that that can happen. It can also happen through school teachers, aunties, uncles, grandmas, nannies. The key is that the other human with you has more capacity, more ability to attune to help you if you need something. Next line, if the wiring was not optimal in early life, we need to build, that's the word, build the foundations and teach, that's the next word, and teach the body what self-regulation and co-regulation is. So this is that time in the course where, and I'm making an observation from past and a generalization where if one did not have that good primary wiring, it's possible, and I'm just going to name it, that your system is disconnecting a little bit right now, might be getting pissed, it might be looking for a way to distract. Just putting that out there, right? This, I see a few nods. Because this goes right to the core. You won't necessarily remember that when you cried, nobody came, or that when you were hungry, you were denied food, or you were overfed. Some babies get overfed, right? This often is the case when we can't breastfeed a little one. We think, we've got to finish that bottle because we've filled it up. But you don't breastfeed in relationship to volume. It's just baby is hungry, they feed, they stop, okay, done. Baby is hungry again, they feed, they stop, done. Whereas if we fill up a bottle, there's this pressure, right? You've got to keep finishing the bottle, fill the bottle, it keeps getting forced in the mouth. And that is a way in which we can overdo it with a little one who's just not hungry anymore. And then their system goes into some form of, I would assume, survival response. So, I share some of these things because it is important to know that this will hit home, and that's okay. That's what's going to happen, right? That shows we're actually getting into these layers. And while a lot of what I went through on the first three pages is 2 pages is complex, it's actually not at the same time. There's a couple branches, there's some sub branches, and then there's another branch, and then there's some tones. And your system has them internally, and it's doing what it can, the best it can with those systems. And then, of course, as we grow capacity, and that's what we're doing here in SBSM, these survival responses shift. They shift out of more survival and into more rest, digest, and into more ventral, more connection. That's essentially what we want. Okay. So, notes on co-regulation and self-regulation. So, this primary wiring is how we learn to self-regulate. It's actually quite basic. In the odd way that I'm saying this, co-regulation leads to self-regulation, right? When we have another connected person, and they're letting us know our experience is valid, and they're helping us with our fear, with our hunger, with our cold, with our heat. It allows us to go, oh, this is okay. And then we come out of our stress response. And then, interestingly enough, we learn self-regulation via co-regulation. So these things intertwine. One example I'll give, I haven't thought of this in a while, so some of you have heard this. This is a very basic example of a mom not seeing the cues. So ages ago, this was like over 7 years ago, I was in a, we would call them here in Canada, a drugstore. So where you would get like shampoo and medicines and band-aids and all that kind of stuff. And it was the winter. And it was actually, I believe it was freezing here in Vancouver, which is not common. And I was wearing my big, heavy down coat. And I went into this drugstore to get something. And, you know, the lights are fluorescent, the heat is on. There's all the chemicals in the air from all the shampoos and detergents. And I could hear this baby just wailing, so upset. And as I got to the back, baby was in a stroller, a pram. And what do you think was happening with their skin? Can you make a guess? You think that the baby was really cold or really hot? So they had come in, and the baby had so many clothes on because they had just been outside, you know, the coat, the toque, the blankets, the gloves, the booties. And this poor little thing was just, and she or he was super hot. And mom was not being very nice. Mom was telling the baby to be quiet and shut up. And mom clearly wasn't in a good state herself. So she had no attunement. She couldn't see. To her, it's just crying baby. So, of course, here you have probably a mother who has her own level of dysregulation, doesn't know how to tune, you know, no blame on her, but that's what's happening. And the little one was just overheating, right? And if you know anything about babies, they actually can tolerate cold really well because they have a lot of fat on them. They have a lot of what's called brown fat, and it insulates them. So we tend to bundle up babies because it's fun with all the knitted sweaters and that that grandmas make, but they don't need it. They don't need a lot of insulation. So anyway, I always think of that little baby when I think about attunement, because that's how simple it is. Baby was hot, I believe, just needed to be relieved of all these clothings and cooled down. And yes, of course, the maybe the smells in the store, the fluorescent lights, all those things, right? So small example that has less to do about anything too rocket sciencey. It's just temperature. And this is why I always say follow your impulse. Are you too hot? Are you too cold? Listen to your body's temperature as a way to self-regulate. and give yourself what your body needs. Now, what's interesting, however, if I think about myself in this exact moment, when I started this call, I was a little extra warm for some reason. I think it's because I was moving around the house. And today is a little cooler outside, so the heat was on the house. When I first started feeling, I could feel a little sweat under my armpits. But because I'm an adult and my system has self-regulation, so this is the important distinction between a baby and an adult. Obviously, when I started, I didn't need to rip off my shirt and be in my tank top. I didn't need to go and open a window and get ventilation in here, right? I have self-regulation, so I was able to self-regulate and cool down with a little bit of sweat. And I'm not moving as much, so my heart rate isn't as high, and so my system feels a lot cooler. Now it's November. If it was August and we were doing this call, I'd probably be wearing different clothing. I might even have the AC on, right? So again, this just shows how when we have more autonomic nervous system regulation, we can self-regulate. We don't always have to go to extremes. But those little people, the little ones, they don't have that yet, right? And that's why we have to feed on demand, help them with temperature, all the things. Okay. So I've kind of already mentioned the next 3 points in this story. But for the sake of going through them, let's go through them. So, this is in reference again on co-regulation and self-regulation. So, for example, the baby does not have self-regulation when born. This is a given. Baby does not have self-regulation when they're born. Ah, yeah, thanks. Someone just mentioned baby sweat glands haven't finished developing either. There you go. Just like their immune system isn't fully developed, right? When they're little. It's actually why they need to be exposed to things. They need to go outside. They need to be in the biome. Babies that are really, really protected and not exposed to different environments, different foods. I can't name research, but I know I've seen stuff that has showed that those babies tend to have more allergies. They're not as well adjusted because they've been really sheltered. Right. So, this ability, I know there's a video that was on social ages ago where all these toddlers were playing in mud. Anybody see that? And they're just covered from head to toe in mud. I think they were maybe in Denmark, somewhere in Europe, just having a great old time, not worrying about anything. Right. So, they don't have self-regulation. They don't have that myelination. To give you a more specific motor example, if you have a pen, everyone pick up your pen, right? You can, again, you can make little fine marks in the air because you know how to write. I'm assuming everybody knows how to write. You know how to use chopsticks. Some of us might know how to use chopsticks, right? Some of us might know how to knit, type, obviously. When you have a newborn baby, their little hands are very undifferentiated. When they get something, they grab, right? They don't have the pinching fine motor. This thing that we're doing here, this is because of myelination. This is because of that portion of our nervous system that has been trained with skill. But they don't have that yet, right? Same with the ability to speak, manipulate the tongue, the throat. This is why, again, it's super important. I think we know this. We need to talk to babies. They need to hear voice. They need to hear different tones. They don't need to learn how to read when they're 2 months old. They need to hear, right? They need to hear. They need to experience. They need to feel. So, number two, she learns how to self-regulate by co-regulating with mom, dad, or the caretaker. And this is just one of the hallmarks to healthy attunement between infant and adult, having that connection with a more mature, regulated nervous system so the infant gets those primary wirings from the start to forming self-regulating and more emotionally intelligent human being. Number three, She learns how to self-regulate based on how she is taught in the co-regulation dance. That's the word. It's a dance. It's a back and forth. You've got to be in connection and have that constant symbiosis back and forth with the primary figure. And the baby is, and I have this in quotes, borrowing her caretaker's ventral vagal parasympathetic nervous system. So when baby sees eyes and a face that has ease and calm and lightness in the eyes, right? I think many of us know that you can have a conversation with someone just by seeing what their eyes tell you. Obviously, if you have pets, you can do that, right? You kind of look at your dog and you turn your head and do a little gesture, and they kind of, oh, is it time for dinner? You know, they know. Is it time for a walk? They know. And that ability to have that ease and lightness with an infant is what teaches them, oh, the world is safe. They feel, they know that that is a strong regulated system. Now, of course, if we didn't have that, that baby learns fear. That baby learns fright. That baby is held with hands that don't have that softness. And who here has ever had a hug from someone and it's pokey, right? There isn't that softness. It's very scary. Yeah. It's no fault of the person. They probably don't know it, but they're, you know, they might really want to see you, but their system has an edge, right? So if you think about an infant who's handled constantly by a caregiver, a nanny, a mother, a father who has that edge, they then learn that that is what the world is. And again, this comes back to why we're here, where we are relearning to rewire how we sensory and motor move through the world, right? So this again, I know this is a big leap, but this is why we're doing Feldenkraisian movements. We're learning how to soften our pelvis, how to feel our spine. We haven't gotten to the bell hand movements yet, but those are about refining and really, really working with fine-tuning our movements in our hand because our hands connect to our higher brain. So I get excited because this is how this stuff all connects. We're not just saying, I need you guys to go fix your vagus nerve, right? With some stimulation. Because you can't raise a baby with a vagus nerve stimulator. I know I'm making a really extreme example, but I always say, go back to the baby. If that baby can't learn self-regulation via these various techniques, then chances are we can't learn it as adults. We've got to go through this process of motor development, sensory development, following our impulses, using our cognition to say, ooh, I think I'm getting a little more into fight flight right now. I better remind myself of feeling my bum on my chair. Or, oh, I think I'm going into a bit of freeze because I've got so much to do and I'm tripping on stuff all the time, right? I'm losing my external awareness because I'm in that fight flight, for example. So, lots of topics today, and yet it's really one topic, right? It's about self-regulation, co-regulation, how we experience self, how we experience the world. Oh, good. Someone said that just landed for me why vagus nerve stimulation isn't the answer. I'm glad I got that across today, right? It's so attractive. Just like all those funny exercise devices in the 80s that said, if you do this for 10 minutes a day, you'll have perfect abs, you know, after a month. It doesn't work, right? It's much more complex than that. Page five, there's no detail here except some references, but I'll just give a little blurb on each. Some of you maybe have already seen all these. These are much older videos that I've done. The story of Teddy. This actually was re-released. So that's probably an old one, but it doesn't matter. It's the same story. This is a great, for those of you who like history and like to understand complex stories. The story of Teddy is my video where I break down the early trauma that Theodore Kaczynski had. He was he's passed now. He was called the Unabomber. He did a lot of bad stuff in the United States to innocent people, and he had a lot of early trauma, a lot of early trauma, and a lot of trauma throughout his childhood and in his late teens. So that's a good one to understand because it shows the complexity of how these things play out. The story of Ryan, why secure attachment is essential, is me breaking down a case study that's written up in Bruce Perry's book, Born for Love. Bruce Perry is a phenomenal educator. He's a psychiatrist, he's a medical doctor. Some of you maybe have heard of him. I think he's done some more limelight work recently. But he was the guy, I don't think he does this anymore. When there was a real bad tragedy that involved children, he would be brought into the courtroom. So he was brought in originally when the, I'm gapping on what occurred again. It was in Waco, Texas. It was when David Koresh had a cult in the United States, and it was really, really bad. And a lot of kids were under the influence of these adults who were under the influence of a cult leader. And these kids were completely, they were not good when they come out, when they came out of this cult. And so he goes in to try to figure out how to help rehabilitate these children if possible. Because the thing is, again, I said this a couple training calls ago, if you're here and you're like able to like go through this, and you know, I see a lot of your backgrounds, you've got nice spaces, nice enough, you know, you've got electricity, no doubt you have food to eat. You've done pretty good in the grand scheme. I know that seems really simple, but these children that he worked with and had to work with and help, they'll never be successful in society because they were so damaged as children, many of them, right? And so this is the importance of sometimes just enough attachment is okay, right? Just enough is okay. And then the final one, and so the story of Ryan, sorry, I didn't complete that, is about one specific child who was then a teenager and his gruesome story of bad secure attachment, really insecure attachment as a infant. He had, I think it was like, I can't remember, I think it was like a, it was like 8 to 10 nannies within 18 months. Because his mother didn't like the fact that the baby got more attached to the nanny than her. And so she would fire the nanny anytime he got attached to a new caregiver. And then that was really harmful for him in the end. And then the final one is a bit more fun. How to Tame a Tantrum. This is a personal story of mine when Seth and I were traveling in Rome. In 2017, I think, and it talks about how I helped a little boy who was experiencing a lot of abuse from his family when we were touring the Colosseum, and all he needed, this little 5-year-old, was someone to play with. He didn't need rocket science. He didn't need to know about the Roman era. He just wanted to play with the rocks. So I talk about how even with children at that age 5, we still need to connect and attach and be at their level of play, and that's what they want for security. You know, they don't need adult things. They need play, they need fun, and they need to know that someone is there interested in them. So that's a funner video if you want to see something a little lighter. Okay, thank you everyone. Thanks Rebecca for being here in the chat. And as always, I'm going to go back to what I said at the very beginning. Go at your own pace. There's no rush. You can't rush teaching a child or a baby how to walk. It has to happen in their own time. The key is that the circumstance, right, the environment is supportive. And so do what you can to support your environment, to follow your impulse, to really listen to your own boundaries, all those things. Thanks, Rebecca, for being in the chat. Thanks for Susan for being on the sidelines, making sure all things are running smoothly. training call on Thursday, not training call, Q&A call with Seth on Thursday. And he will be doing your training call next week on healthy aggression, part two. And enjoy the week's lessons, whatever you're working on. Go slow, enjoy, bring yourself back to that state of curiosity in a beginner's mind. Super important. And yeah, if you aren't sure how to send in a Q&A, go to the Q&A page. It tells you everything there, how to do it. Okay, thanks everyone. Be gentle, get up, step away from your computer for a bit. And we will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.